You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems.
I remember one night, don't ask me how this happened, but I was at the concert for Jay-Z and Beyonce. Yeah. With like an ex-girlfriend of mine.
Uh-huh.
And it was a total nightmare like to get to because it was at the Met Stadium. And so there were like shuttles from the stadium to the vaunted Port Authority of New York bus station, which is just like a fucking cesspool to begin with. But we get back at like 2 or 3 a.m. and everyone's trying to get a cab, and the cabbies are saying, "Where are you going?" And people are like, and then he goes, no, I can't go. And then like this happened a bunch. And then finally, this made me love cops, because a cop came up and was like, "Yo, your job is, it is illegal to turn people down and ask them where they're going. Your job is to get people home, period. I will write you up." And I was like, you know, whatever the inverse of fuck the police is, go police.
You want to pull a blue life matter in that moment.
Yes, indeed. All right. I guess we'll roll into it. Welcome back to another episode of System of Systems, the audio misinformation arm of the Safety Propaganda Counterintelligence Network. These are your hosts, Pretty Boy Adam Lehrer
and Will Sampson.
And we have a spectacular guest with us tonight. He is a friend of mine. He is one of my favorite painters in New York right now. And he was also the sole homosexual attendee of my bachelor party, which will surely go down in the annals of 2020's New York avant-garde history as a much mythologized event. Nevertheless, Kevin Tobin, welcome to the show.
Hey. yeah, not only that, but I'd never been to a bachelor party, so you were actually my first bachelor party too.
You always remember your first.
Or not, depending on what you were doing that night.
True that. Yeah, we did MDMA, alcohol. We ended up at Scorpion Lounge.
Scorpion Lounge. Is that the place where all the guys look like hobbits and all the girls look like Victoria's Secret models?
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's a really shocking mixture there.
Well, the funniest thing is both times we've been on MDMA together, we've ended up without even trying to at the Scorpion Lounge in Jackson Heights. It has like a mesmeric allure. Like, Will, I can't even really, like, the vibe of this place is so bizarre. Okay. It's in, like, Jackson Heights is a weird place. It's mostly a Latinx area in Queens.
Okay.
But it definitely has, like, now sort of a, it's sort of like what Bushwick was in the early 2000s. Like,
okay.
Like, you know, old neighborhood folks types. Gangbangers and like litterings of like rich kid losers living on stipends from their mom and dad, you know?
Okay.
And Scorpion Lounge is very clearly a gangbanger bar. And their thing is like you walk in and it's all these like little Mexican guys and Puerto Ricans and shit. I mean, of varying degrees of menace, if you will. And then the waitresses are unanimously, I'm telling, like, you could go to the hottest bars and clubs in Brooklyn and Manhattan, and you will not get the volume of 10 out of 10 cocktail waitresses that this place has. And they're all just like there getting sexually harassed by the gangbangers. It's like a very weird place. And every time Kevin and I go in, or both times we've gone in, we're like, this fucking place again? Like, why do we keep going here?
I mean, I can understand why you guys keep ending up there, because every time I see those women, I think, I just wonder what a heterosexual man sees when he sees that, you know? Because yeah. I so rarely look at women, even though I live with one. Yeah, I don't know.
It's... And the gangbangers aren't like too menacing either. I think they're more like
they're
curious and mystified by our arrival.
Yeah, okay. No, exactly. No, they're not like I certainly wouldn't say it's a threatening place, but
like I remember at one point, you know, because I was all wobbly and drunk and high and whatnot, that I get a little too loose with my body movements. Like, it's something Michelle complains about all the time. I get too, like, wobbly. And I accidentally brushed up one of the banger's ass with my hand. And I remember thinking, like, oh, fuck, he's going to kill me. And the guy goes, is like, no hay problema, chico. No hay problema. Like, he actually had a good sense of humor about it. And at that point I was like, oh hell yeah, I feel like I'm at home right now, can I join your gang, blah blah blah. But
I'm gonna be in New York for a Morrissey show in November. Should I hit this place up after the show?
Where are you going? What show?
To see Morrissey.
Nice. I didn't know he was doing a show in November.
Yeah, November 30th. It might be in Brooklyn, but yeah. Are you saying that after I see Morrissey, I should hit up the Scorpion Lounge stuff? Is that the move?
Yes. I will even take you if you want. And maybe,
I would love that.
Yeah. And maybe I will and maybe I'll get tickets to the Morrissey show.
Hell yeah. It would be dope to see you in person, especially in that fucking context.
I know. I'm supposed to go see the Pumpkins on Wednesday.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, Kev, you have a show at Luboff Gallery.
Yes, I have a show up through October 30th. So I have two more weekends. And then we say goodbye. Which is weird to work on something for 18 months and think that it's all over in 2 weeks, which is maybe why I'm a little grumpy. But I took a 5-hour energy and I'm on my second drink, so hopefully that will help spice me up.
Have you been made wildly rich? Are you just
absolutely not? No.
Fuck.
I wish. Actually, some of my other friends who are painters that are showing right now, it's almost like no one I know is getting any sales. So I don't know if it's because of the market. I don't know if it's because my paintings are too good and original. Actually, that could be going against me at this point.
Yeah, you could just like rebrand entirely. Like, just do a picture of like
I was thinking of coming out as a
Amanda Gorman.
I'm not sure anyone knows yet.
Yeah, I mean being a gay white won't get you very far anymore though.
No. I keep having to correct people because people are like, oh, so you're like a queer artist or like queer figuration. And I was like, no, I'm solidly a faggot.
More like jizz figuration.
Yeah. Yeah, more like abject dude on dude. Doesn't even show up in the paintings, but my sex life is a lot sexier than my paintings are, for sure.
Before we get into all that, It is a bit weird that sales are flat right now. I read that recently because it seems like it bucks sort of market trends, because typically in a time of a market free fall, buying hard assets such as paintings is a great fucking idea. For instance, my Darya Bahajic painting over there. She just got signed to Downs and Ross Gallery, and they listed it on their website as one of the examples. I'm going to assume that I could probably hawk that thing for at least five times what I got it for.
Yeah. Well, I've only ever bought one painting, and it's probably worth at least 10 times what I paid for it. So
what'd you get?
I got a Miriam Khan painting like 11 years ago. So,
oh, great. Yeah. You like her work.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've seen paintings go up, I guess in the last year, there's been like multiple small sort of portrait heads that have gone for like over 100,000, which is crazy. Yeah. So, and that's kind of what I have. And the one that I have is, I would say, better than the ones that have gone up at auction. So I don't have an insured, and I was like, I think it's about time that I get some insurance on that.
Yeah. I've never done that for any of the stuff I own. That's probably a bad idea.
Yeah. I'm going to contact the dealer that represents her and just be like, hey, what kind of insurance should I get on this?
I mean, yeah, all the artwork that I have that I've bought, I've gotten either via gift or just like cash transactions with artists that I'm friends with. You know, I got a Shannon Cartier Lucy print that she gave us for our wedding. I have a Brad Kessler painting that I wanted for years that he gave to me as a wedding gift. I have an Alex Hardashnikov painting that he sold to me for a very cheap price and is now the cover of my debut book, Communions, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know, like I came into some money like halfway into the middle of the pandemic, and it seemed like a good idea to buy some of this stuff because it is like a good investment. Now, with just like the market's dwindling, I feel less confident making any sort of heavy purchase like that. And also, that kind of just reminds me, Michelle's been saying this too. You know, Michelle works in arts publicity, and she's been stressed out a lot of the time because I think there's a general lack of enthusiasm for contemporary art writ large. Like she's managing huge shows and is still having trouble getting like seasoned art journos to write about anything.
Yeah.
What do you think that's about?
You know what? I don't really know, but yeah, I mean, I think that there's a certain population of, there's a large group of the ones that are sort of, I don't know, maybe the core group that everybody, you know, Roberta, Jerry, Peter, Ken. There's like the core people that like everyone sort of just like, you know, reads whether or not they like them or not. And yeah, like a lot of them are not really very active right now. And some of them are having health problems. So like, I think that there's, and the younger ones, like, I don't know who they are. Like, half of the people that I see, like, that are writing for the New York Times, I've, like, never heard of.
Yeah.
That are, like, new writers. It's like they're going through this period of, like, trying out new writers, it seems like.
Yeah, it seems so.
I don't know. It seems like Jason Parago is, like, writing pretty regularly. He's maybe the only one that is, but, like.
The only, like, real writer, it would seem.
Or like Will Heinrich, I don't know. He seems to write pretty regularly. But other than that, it's like, it seems like they're trying out a lot of.
Well, I think that a lot of that just goes into the fucking economics of it. Like, I don't even really consider myself an art critic anymore because I'm not like, I mean, I'm not really going to shows that much. And I'm certainly not like doing a regular reviews kind of thing that I used to do. But
yeah.
I'm more just like a more just like a avant-garde hate monger, you know. And sometimes art falls within that. But someone like Sean Tatel, who I get compared to a lot, or I at least get brought up alongside sometimes in the Manhattan Art Review, I personally don't think we have that much overlap in what we do, other than that we both use the internet. But like, if you're someone like him, and I think to his credit, he actually does have something. He has a voice, you know, he has something to say about art. You can get so much more attention and so much more clout just by building your own platform. And ultimately, like, I actually discussed this with one of my one of the publishers of Compact Magazine. And he was like, you know, a lot of people in the industry are going to look down on something like Substack. But Substack gave the writers some economic power back, because if I'm going to peel you away from your platform, I'm going to have to match you at least what you make on that platform, if not exceed it vastly, because everyone wants to employ themselves over someone else. So it's like,
you're also not beholden to like the arbitrary. Well, it's not arbitrary. It's actually very calculated, but you're not, obviously, if you're writing for a place like the New York Times, you're just like beholden to whatever their editing agenda. Like, if you have anything to say that's going to be like remotely novel or possibly exciting or controversial, they're gonna edit that out. So like,
yeah,
the only way that you can even make, I think, even be honest in many ways is to be on something like Substack.
That's so true. Yeah, I mean, people make fun of, I mean, and there is kind of like a thing now, just like everyone started a Substack. There's always like a positive and a negative to all this shit. Like, positive is it gave me a platform, you know, me specifically, above all else, always. But the negative is that, like, everyone on Twitter is now like, check out my Substack. And it's just like, there's so many, like, writing on there now that's like, I looked into the soul of the internet and I saw my reflection inside of the collective unconscious of the digital space, like that sort of surrealist e-girl kind of thing. I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah.
But I, you know, with that, there's way less incentive. I think what's going to happen is like art criticism itself will just continue slowly to dying, because the only incentive to write about every show is if one of these fucking magazines is paying you to write and go to every show.
Yeah. I also don't even know, like, the people that, I mean, the sort of, at the end of the day, it's just the people with the most money that seem to control the art world. And like, what do they read, or do they even read at all? Like, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that they're not necessarily listening to any specific voice, unless it's like, I don't know, Hans Ulbrich Obrist or some fucking bullshit like that. But like, they're just listening to like whatever the superstar curator of the moment, but they're not like writing about new art. So it's like, who's writing about new art? It's like, nobody seems to want to go out on a limb and actually do that. Or if they are, they're just kind of like writing about the new art that is like the most obvious, like new figurative painter that just graduated from Yale. It's like, well,
right. Well, you have like the Zvetnik platform, but that's just like photos, and it's all like, and I'm so sick of their aesthetic at this point. It's like post-apocalypticism, like, and it was cool for a while, but now the Zvetnik thing is just kind of like, if it looks semi-dark or there's like a demon in the painting or like a cyberpunky aesthetic, they'll put it up. So that kind of feels flat like it doesn't, now at this point.
It has absolutely no, like, I never even look at it, so I don't really know, but, like, is it just pretty much, like, it doesn't really matter if the quality is good or not, if it just fits within that sort of category.
Within, exactly, yeah. There's lots of ripping off going at this point, which kind of makes sense because, like, the platform's become kind of big and popular and kids want to get on it. And then I'm sure that has some sort of a subconscious impact. Did you see that? Will, are you familiar with Zvetnik?
I think I've heard you bring him up before in passing, but I don't really know much about him.
They're Russian. And, yeah, they're two Russian, I think, curators, but art enthusiasts one way or the other. And I've heard that they are very Duganist in their politics. And yet, I think something interesting just happened because they just made an announcement about what it's like. Like, they just totally apostatized and called Putin a Nazi terrorist, blah, blah, blah. I think what happened is maybe one of them is in the Russian Reserve Army and might be looking at getting called to fight. So they're like looking for funding to getting out of the country. It's pretty wild. This is total conjecture, by the way. I have no idea.
But you've heard rumors of this potentially being the case.
Many people are saying this. Many people are saying this.
I mean, it sounds like tons of people are fleeing that don't want to be called up to fight in a useless war.
I mean, totally. I wouldn't be stoked about having to fight.
No one wants to, no one wants to be fighting this war.
If I had to choose a side, I'd probably fight for Russia. No, sorry, FBI, I didn't mean that. All right.
Satire. That was a joke.
Satire. I mean, sure. Do I respect Vladimir Putin a lot more than our leaders? Yes. No. Come on. It's a joke, of course.
I mean, I'm a sissy fag, and I don't really think that I'll do really well in either place. So.
Yeah. Right. You would like come into your own in violent conflict. You would just be like clawing. You'd be like Pierre Guillotat, Eden, just like clawing out the eyes of desecrated corpses. Like, you'd be like
I'd be having some crazy battlefield sex too, probably.
Like faggot Rambo, just like fucking all your enemy combatants to death on the battlefield.
I'd be like the ultimate military bottom or something. Like, I don't know.
You'd be the coolest guy on that fucking battlefield, that's for damn sure.
Yeah, I'd make sure all those soldiers weren't, you know, all pent up.
Absolutely. The Azov Battalion butt boy.
Yeah, I just, you know, they can't, if there's no, pussy around, I guess they'll just have to go for the pussy. And I guess that's fine.
I really, 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 Apocalypse Confidential magazine is doing a issue centered around war. And I really wanted to write like a screwball comedy set within the Azov.
Yeah.
But I haven't gotten around to it. But I just thought like you could write this quaint story about like an Azov family and the husband's about to go to war. And the wife's like, I'm so proud of you, honey, running these dirty fucking Slavs off our land. And once we take care of them, we'll fucking finally deal with the real question, the Jewish question. Yo, speaking of.
Oh, Kanye?
Yo, I just finished that interview. Holy shit.
I haven't watched the whole thing yet, but I've only seen the clips that have made it on like Instagram and Twitter, but it seems fucking insane.
I only saw
crazy.
So wait, what is I saw you sent it to me earlier. What, who is interviewing him after?
It's this hip hop interview show called Drink Champs, which is hosted by Noriega from Capone and Noriega, which did one of my favorite hip-hop albums ever of all time, actually, The War Report. But Noriega, he's like a very he's got like kind of a happy-go-lucky demeanor, but he's kind of annoying. Actually, there's this interview with Cam'ron, and Cam'ron's like very serious, intelligent sort of guy, and Noriega keeps like, yo man, you gotta have a drink right now, dog, it's Drink Champs, and Cam'ron's like, I'm not drinking. It's 11 in the morning. I'm not doing this right now. Like, so there's usually like some tension sometimes. But Kanye has now gone on 3 times. His interviews are always kind of a delight, and he really sort of opens up on the platform. But today's interview, he just instantly goes into not like maybe anti-Semitic kind of stuff, but we're talking like straight up Wignat talking points pulled straight from 4chan. And my favorite line in the whole thing, and I can't believe he was, and the thing is like he was so like shocking that Noriega and the co-host didn't even really know how to respond to anything. So they kept going, yeah, 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 yeah. You know, it was above their heads. And at one point, Kanye goes, all praise be to my brother Ice Cube. He really influenced me to get on this anti-Semitic vibe right now. Like, he just called himself an anti-Semite.
What a mess.
Yeah. And like my impulse right now is to kind of, I mean, there is something I think that's annoying about this iteration of Kanye go around. Cause God, the guy's like on a 6 month, it seemed every 6 months, he's the center of controversy. He's great at it. And I used to defend him completely because I thought he was legitimately great. But now there's this thing where it just seems like he's like repeating low IQ rightoid talking points from like 2 years ago. And it almost is like exposing like the intellectual cowardice of the right in a lot of ways, because they're always just like so jazzed and excited when a black guy will say what they want him to say. And
they'll literally just take any, I mean, obviously Kanye is somebody who's very powerful, so it would be from somebody, but like, yeah, they'll just take any black person at this point.
Yeah. And I've always just found that to be annoying. Like, if this is what you believe, then you shouldn't need anyone to reaffirm that, you know. I don't know, what do you think, Will?
I mean, granted, I have not watched the whole interview thing, but based on what we were talking about earlier, like in text this morning, I'm kind of leaning towards like, yeah, he's probably just having like an episode, and that's maybe like the best explanation for this. At the same time, part of me does wonder like if there isn't some grander, like
performance art like aspect of this that I'm just not clicking into or something, but like that's just speculation. Yeah.
I think like all of it's true at the same time, basically. Like, yeah. I think he is having an episode, and I think he's also conscious that there's a performative element to this, and I think you can still be right about some things if you're having an episode, right? Like, Antonin Artaud was crazy as a fucking loon, but obviously hit on some, like, really resonant transcendental truths. And it is interesting, I think, just to have, like, a figure of his level of fame. Like, he's the most famous artist of the 21st century by, like, far. So there is something interesting to have, like, that guy, you know, saying shit like this that's so sort of negationist. And if there's anything I like about it, it's almost like very situationist in a way.
Right. You know? Yeah.
He's creating a spectacle of negation around himself. But often I think, like, you know, I think Kanye's probably intellectual and intelligent in a way. But not in like the way that maybe we are, you know? Where we have like, yeah. So I think we kind of are over intellectualizing with him sometimes.
I think in general, musical, unless you're like,
unless you're somebody who's, I don't know, I'm not gonna think of an example, but I would say for the most part, people that are musical. As like someone who's a visual artist, I just think that it's something that comes more. There's a reason why, like, at every award show and stuff, they're always like, and I gotta thank God, because it's like, because musical stuff tends to be more innate, and I don't think that, like, outside of the realm of what they do, that they even care to learn that much of other things. Like, it doesn't really
comes from the gut.
Because it doesn't impact what they do. Like, you don't have to be that intellectual to make great music. You actually don't have to be intellectual at all.
Yeah, I've actually been reading. I have this big book of essays, Richard Meltzer essays. And have you ever read his stuff, Will?
I've been wanting to get around to it, but I haven't yet. I am aware of him though.
Yeah, he's got a cool career. You know, he was, he wrote all the lyrics for the Blue Oyster Cult.
Right. Yeah.
And he's in Smegma at one point, and
I actually didn't know that. That's sick.
Yeah. Oh, and he was like the manager of the Angry Samoans, you know.
Okay.
But his background was very conceptual. You know, he was a student of Alan Caprow. And when he wrote his thesis, this is back in the early 60s. He sold Caprow on writing about rock and roll because his basic position was that this was a very potent artwork divorced of conceptualism almost entirely. That is truly, Caprow had this thing about de-intellectualizing art, and he was like, well, this is it. This is what's going to change the world. And then he was, of course, 100% right. I think it, I think of obviously like avant-garde composition composers and such, obviously think a lot about music and sound and stuff, but like, you know, Elvis Presley, fuck no, he just fucking heard a tune and sang his fucking heart out, you know? Even Michael Jackson, someone like that is probably operating on a level of intuition and heart more than intellect.
Mariah Carey's a beauty school dropout.
Yeah, exactly.
But like immensely kind of freakishly brilliant in her own way, but she's a beauty school dropout, and she's the first one to tell you that.
Yeah. I know this girl who used to work for her.
Yeah, I know quite a few people that have like worked around her and have some very funny stories, but I've heard like everything from she's wonderful to she's a complete nightmare. Like, she sounds like it just depends on which Mariah you get when you're around her.
Many things true all at the same time. Sorry, Will, were you going to say something?
I was just going to chime in on the music thing and just say, I think a lot of times that is the case. I can think of notable exceptions to that, like the, you know, gut versus head thing with musicians. But I think overall it's very true. And it's, especially as someone like who deals with musicians, unfortunately, on like a day-to-day basis for trying to do what he wants to do, it's very frustrating and annoying. It's like more, especially when it comes to people who like are just like casually musicians and like bands that no one like gives a shit about. They more often than not, they would definitely be better suited to actually like attempting to be intellectual, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. That's all I was gonna say. Nothing super.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. I feel like, you know, the guys that I'm friends with probably operate on a level of both. I feel like noise guys probably operate on a level of both. It's like a very Aspergian genre.
I mean, you kind of have to, because it's like you're essentially doing just like sound conceptual art at that point. So there has to be an intellectual to like make the pieces work.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I feel like I balance that out for sure in my own work. But Kev, as a painter, you probably are balancing intellect and gut, or should we say nut, as well.
There's a lot of gut and a lot of nut and some intellect, but mostly gut and nut. And
that's the name of the episode.
I would say, at least in terms of the way that I think, I have a sort of, I would say a lot of visual artists are not particularly historically very literate. Like, they don't necessarily, like, I'm always shocked when I meet other artists that like don't know really obvious, they just have like huge gaps in their art historical knowledge that I just find to be kind of crazy. Whereas I think I have kind of like a surface level knowledge of a lot of stuff. And I also have like a photographic memory. So like, I remember who the artist is, when it was made. I remember all the pieces. I remember most of the titles. So I have this kind of like, and then I also have a lot of books that when I'm in the studio, I'm just like, when I get stuck, I just rifle through books, but I don't necessarily like intentionally quote things all the time. Like, I'm learning that essentially the way that I paint is that I've been accumulating this sort of database of painting throughout history, especially the periods that mean the most to me, and then they kind of just come out in weird ways when I'm actually painting. But it's like through the process of painting is what is I'm learning is what really creates the best paintings. Anyway, like, I might start with an image, but I almost always like obliterate the image and it becomes something else. So I might have like a general idea about, I mean, like, since I've been showing, which is, you know, now this is my second show, that I've had this sort of idea of wanting to paint the figure but not wanting it to be about even the human necessarily. Like, it could be the human, it could be animal, it's certainly not about race or gender identity or sexuality.
No way, even. Dude, you love Black people and you want to save them.
Exactly. Like every good white person does. Yeah, no, I think that there's a lot of uncovered territory in terms of the strange area between the figure and abstraction that has you know, people are like, oh, well, it's already happened. I'm like, well, there was like a very short period of time of like maybe 40 years where it was like really exciting. And then people just moved into pure abstraction. And then now people are making really boring academic figurative paintings again. And I'm like, you know, there's like 40,000 years of art history. And only, I would say only in the last 100 years has this sort of gray area been a really ripe area for painters to kind of deal with. And I don't know, I'm just surprised when I see so many people making just like boring representational paint.
I mean, there's so many fucking artists right now that are doing like what Jamian does.
Yeah.
And I think Jamian's like a fucking genius for reals. Like, that's legitimately funny painting, you know, and like provocative in a lot of ways. But
when she hits it, she really hits it.
Yeah, exactly. And but now everyone is just like, oh, I found these pictures on Tumblr and they're so cute and they sort of speak to my e-girl mystique and my, you know, whatever. It's like, fuck off. I want to see fucking Kev Tobin paint fucking glowing bats against a monochromatic landscape. I want fucking Cy Twombly jizzing blood all over the canvas. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, because Jamian's painting, I mean, actually, it's, as somebody who is now, I mean, my paintings have certainly become a lot more luscious in terms of what I'm doing with the paint. It's a lot more inventive. And even like other painters are like, I don't necessarily know how you do what you do, which is sort of the ultimate compliment.
Yeah.
But for somebody like Jamian, where it's just so rudimentary and just so like, okay, I paint the flat shapes and then I do the airbrush and it creates the image. And like the fact that she could even do that and somehow make a painting that still hits you in this really crazy way. I have a lot of respect for painters that don't even need to be painterly to like get some kind of like weird sucker punch. I mean, like the, I mean, that recent painting of hers that's just like the fucking like 2001 A Space Odyssey thing that just says like Anna Nicole Smith.
Yeah, exactly.
I was just like, what kind of batshit crazy person even comes up with? Or the one, I mean, the one that was one of my favorites was the one, the toilet with the creature from Mulholland Drive.
Mulholland Drive, yeah.
The dumpster. Yeah.
Yeah,
the monster behind Wankies. But I mean, I couldn't tell you for the life of me what I think that she's even trying to do, I guess. But most of the people that are just like sampling stuff from the internet in a kind of just glut of dumb imagery, like it's usually very, very easy to ascertain what they're trying to do with it. Whereas like with her, it's always kind of, you kind of never really know what the point is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
which is what makes it, which is what gives it its intensity.
Because yeah, I think, and I that, think like, sorry, go ahead.
Once you kind of like figure something out, I mean, I always say that it's like the mystery question. Like once you kind of like someone has a goal and they like achieve that goal, it's like, well, then what's the point of doing anything else?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah. You know, I was thinking about this actually again while reading Richard Meltzer, because I've, like I said, I've really been binging through his essays. And I think because of the glut of contemporary art, there's a lot. And it's not just like painting that often feels flat, you know, photography is like impossible to justify now as a fine art practice, unless you're like super good or super intelligent, whatever. And I can think of a few photographers that I really like.
Yeah, pretty much all the stuff that you've brought up on your photographers you've written about recently, I would say, are pretty compelling. And I'm somebody who I would say uniformly, I'm pretty prejudiced against photography. Like, I just really don't care about photography all that much.
Interesting. So, yeah, because I feel like a lot of painters that you probably look up to, like Francis Bacon, were in like constant dialogue with photography.
Yeah, but that's like a love. I think most painters have like a love-hate relationship with photography because,
yeah.
I mean, like I love Marlene Dumas. I think she's an amazing painter, and she paints pretty much from photographs. Yeah. And
she is really good.
She doesn't alter them all that much, but somehow, I don't know. It takes a very specific talent to be able to make a painting that's sort of photo-based without really straying too far from the source material and having it actually do something the photograph doesn't, I guess. Yeah.
I just have a predilection towards photography because I used to be quite serious about it. But even if I'm being honest about myself, it's often hard for me to tell like why a weird photograph on like a industrial music album cover is just working in this context, and why like allegedly one of the great photographers gets to be in galleries. It is kind of hard to tell, but I feel like I know it when I see it, you know, like I love Heji Shin's photography a lot. I love the way that she's like, she takes these sorts of really loaded media tropes, like cops, you know, and then turns it into porn, art porn or whatever.
Yeah, she does some of the best gay porn.
She does.
She's really good at gay porn.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that Hot Cop series was pretty fucking gnarly.
Yeah, I fucking love the Hot Cops. Lives Matter.
But I've been thinking about this recently. Blue Lives do matter. I've been thinking about this recently, like Richard Meltzer.
I've seen a lot of like, I've seen way too many hunky cops recently. I'm like, are they just like trying?
Oh, Kev, you have
trying to get me wet, like in that tunnel underneath. I'm like,
honey, like Michelle. Anyways. I was trying to get her to verify this, but like in Athens, we kept fucking joking because all the cops there are like under 35, ripped, and like the best looking dudes I've ever seen in my life. Like, it's a weird fucking vibe. They all got their short shorts. They're all like super tan, and they all like chill and kind of like homoerotic poses with each other and shit.
I think I need to go to Athens. Oh, yeah, that's my name.
You would love it. You'd like it more than anybody.
Since I'm such a gay coomer.
Gay coomer, and also your appreciation for just like class, like formalism and shit.
Yeah, it's just all these like ancient ruins with just like hot fucking dude cops.
Yeah, ushering you in and out.
Do they carry they carry guns, and how big are their guns?
Not all of them. I think I'd say like half of them were carrying guns, but I'm not sure like what distinguishes the cop with the gun and the cop without the guns. There's not much crime in Athens besides drug trafficking, of course, and like the occasional act of political terror. Like Antifa in Athens is like very next level. They're very like extra with their violent threats and such. I mean, Greek politics are very weird anyways. They're very, like, strange.
Hmm.
Oh, sorry. I keep getting sidetracked. So, like, I've been thinking about this. Like, Richard Meltzer, it took, like, a leap of courage for him to be the guy to identify that music was, and pop music and specifically, it was like now the most important art form as opposed to, you know, visual art or literature in the 60s. And now it seems like literature, of course, my field is like totally dead. And music, there's still a ton of great stuff made, but it definitely does not have the sort of cultural meaning that it once used to occupy as like a connective tissue, universalizing force, if you will. And the art world is still huge in its way, but disconnected from the broader cultural discourse. So I've been wondering who will be the Richard Meltzer to rise up and identify the new, the current form of media that is most important to our times. Is it podcasts? Is it independent publishing? I'm too close to it, you know? I can't, like, declare these things on my own. But I am curious about that. Like, in 10 years, will we look back on something or someone as the person to be like, music is gay, books are gay, painting is gay, podcasts are the shit. You know, I don't know. What do you think?
Who are we talking to? I guess
both of you.
Well,
I have an answer. I want to let him go first.
Yeah, you go first, or you want me to go first?
Yeah, because I thought he was asking you, so I'll let you try to answer first. But I have a concrete answer that I think will be obvious to Adam, like who I'm going to say. But, yeah.
Okay, you go first then.
Go ahead, Will.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say Jack. I think it's Jack. Unironically, I think it's Jack from TPN.
Probably. It is crazy the extent to which, like, he has a take and then everybody just adopts it, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like I sometimes even want to push back on it because I'm like, why does he get to define like everything that's good for this crew? But
I don't entirely understand it, but that's just the niche that he's sort of, I guess, half risen to and half just cultivated. But like, it's unquestionably, I think, well deserved and earned. But it's just a weird phenomenon to sort of ask yourself why it happened. I don't know. I'm very glad it did. I certainly wouldn't be right now doing this if it wasn't for Jack. So, yeah.
I think that's true. Yeah. I think that's true. Kev, what do you think?
Well, I've been thinking about it a lot recently since, of course, when I first moved to New York and got out of school, I was working for Elizabeth D, and it was like the height of Ryan Tricarton mania when he had the giant show at PS1. And recently I've rewatched quite a few of them, and I'm just, it's crazy how much someone just sends me like a TikTok or something, and the way that these things are even edited is just straight out of a Ryan Tricarton film from like 12 years ago. And like the ability for people to make home movies into something that's like uncanny and strange and visual and maybe not narrative or maybe narrative, and that it doesn't necessarily require a giant budget, like, I'm kind of surprised there aren't more, or maybe I'm just not in tune with it because I'm too much into painting, but like, I'm just surprised there aren't more, because he even hated calling his pieces video art. Like, he didn't think of himself as a video artist. He thought of himself as a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't even think of himself as a filmmaker. He thought of himself as somebody who makes movies.
Yeah.
So like, I guess that there's some sort of hybrid video related thing that could be somewhere between movie, somewhere, and I don't think that like it can be people that somehow, I think universally it's not going to be anyone who comes out of art schools, because right. If you've gone to art school, it'll just ruin any innovative idea that you could do with a camera.
It's true.
Preach.
I mean, cinema has actually been spectacular this year, like big cinema. Amazing. Like, I think Blonde is one of the best movies I've ever seen, like, straight up.
No, it's incredible. Yeah.
Gaspar's new movie was great. Fucking Lena Dunham's movie was fantastic.
What is Lena Dunham's movie?
Oh, it's called Sharpstick. Oh, Kev, you would love this shit. It's like this sort of like autistic virgin girl, but like very beautiful, but just like autistic and unable to connect to men. She's the babysitter for a married couple played by Lena Dunham, and hilariously, she's married to John Bernthal. I love that Lena does that shit. She's like, in this movie, John Bernthal is my husband.
And then the girl, where she puts herself in the wild affair with Patrick Wilson
early. Right, exactly. And people were so retarded for like being shocked by that. Like, that totally fucking happens. Like, just because he's handsome and she's sort of dowdy and frumpy does not mean he would not fuck her for a couple days of easy sex. Like, that's real life, people. Sorry.
No, it's like very, it's very realistic. I see it on the street all the time.
The fucking time. All the time.
So many hot straight guys with so many like frumpy, bow-legged, short, slightly overweight, or even more than slightly overweight girls. So it's like, you know, but Lena is, I'm a big fan. I think she's pretty spectacular.
Oh, she definitely is. We're definitely in support of her. Michelle is her mom's publicist, so I am dying for the day that I will get to meet her.
Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to it. And I mean, I'm a huge fan of Carol Dunham. I think he's a pretty.
Oh, me too. One of my favorite painters. Yeah, I met him. I've met him at Michelle had to do a Salon 94 event, and he was there. And I was like, "Can you please introduce me to him?" He was very gracious, nice man.
Yeah, he seems like a really nice man.
But yeah, and like, God, there was just so many films this year that I liked, and there's still movies by Park Chan-wook coming out. There's movies by
Oyslin.
Oh man, I'm psyched for that one. Yeah. Park Chan-wook is one of the best of the best. The Handmaiden was like, when The Handmaiden came out, I was like, a 3-hour erotic porno thriller with beautiful Asian girls scissoring each other at the halfway point of the fucking movie. Could you have written this? Like, was this movie like written for me specifically? Come on now.
They were just like, how do we make Adam Coombe the hardest?
Park Chan-wook has got me covered, dude.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. It's weird because there's all this like amazing work that comes out, and I'm an autistic freak, so I just like consume everything. But it's still, even with like the greatness of all the work being done, it does have a much flatter cultural reception now. Everything's fragmented. Everything is, it always feels secondary, you know? Even if, like, what was cool about Blonde is it did create a cultural discussion because of the outrage mob that formed around it. But still, that ended up being very fleeting. I think it'll take a few more years before it's justly reappraised as a masterpiece.
Yeah, people just freaked out about that, like, baby thing.
Yeah. Oh, God.
What?
Sorry, I turned on Gotnya Cry by accident.
Oh.
Nazi black metal band. Before we talk about our least favorite painters, can you explain to our audience your marriage situation? Yeah, and she's a great artist.
She's one of the few people, I would say, of any art form. I would say sculpture is sort of dying in a... She kind of comes from a very dying breed of sculptor, like out of the tradition of David Smith and Louise Bourgeois, and you know, they don't make sculptors like that anymore because people don't want it.
Yeah, it's very hard to sell.
It's extremely expensive to make, and it requires a huge, even if you're really technically skilled and can do everything yourself, it still requires an enormous amount of, like, you're very dependent on, like, other people.
Yeah, the gallery.
Yeah, I mean, but you're, like, dependent on other people even to make it, just to fabricate it. If you're, like, working on something that, I mean, one of my favorite stories of hers was, like, when she, like, introduced herself to Robert Morris, you know, this was, like, in the 70s, and you know, he's at the bar with Linda Benglis, and she goes up to him and tells him that, you know, she's like, oh, I'm a big fan of your work and I'm a sculptor or whatever. And he just leans over and he's like, how big is it and how much does it weigh? She was like, well, I'm working on a piece that's like 10 tons and it's 380 feet long. So, Benny was impressed, you know. Yeah. But it was very, I mean, the scale that people were working on back then was just like entirely different.
I mean,
and she got all of the metal for those early pieces from the West Side Highway. She would go up there and wear like a halter top and a mini skirt and like 6-inch heels, and she would like sweet talk a bunch of guys into like stuffing her truck with steel. Yeah. So she just like va-va boomed her way into getting men to take, you know, scrap metal.
Right. No, it's pretty precarious to be a sculptor. I remember even reading that like David Altmed, who's fucking huge. Like when his gallery closed, Andrea The fuck
Andrew Rosen.
He almost like had to give up his entire studio just because he was losing funds for like a week. He was gonna like, Brad told me this actually. He was thinking about quitting art and just becoming a jewelry designer. But luckily that didn't happen. And I know Lionel Mounds is like has to spend a ton of fucking money to produce that work.
Yeah, no, I mean he's amazing.
Oh, big time. He's got a show coming up the day before my reading.
Yeah.
October 27th.
Marsha's a big fan of his too.
Oh yeah, Lionel's fucking awesome.
Cause they actually know there's a woman that Marsha works with, who she's the head of, she runs the foundry at Alfred University, and she does a lot of iron casting. So I know that like Lionel has like worked with her to like, he's worked, I think through Alfred maybe, or that they were like doing, there's like multiple weird, like iron pour situations where like somewhere in Philadelphia, a bunch of like people will go and they all pour iron at the same time. Cause it just like requires so many people to do it. So it's like they all help each other cast each other's pieces. And so I know that they've actually worked with one of the same people to like do some casting.
Mm.
But
yeah, he rules. And he's a cool guy. All right. Shitty painters.
Ugh.
I want to go in right now. Can I tell you one that I'm like really disgusted by?
Yes. Tell me who you are disgusted by.
Amy Sherald.
Yeah.
All of these fucking paintings are just so gross to me. Like, it's just like this total neutering of like every single one of her. I posted this like satire tweet the other day because that Joseph Kenosha or whatever his fucking name was, the black guy who drove his car into a bunch of human beings and killed like 13 people.
Right.
And he was trying to represent himself in court.
Oh God.
It was so funny. And he was saying because none of the victims showed up that his case should be thrown out. And the judge was like, they're dead. Of course they didn't show up. And he was like,
you literally killed
Your Honor, this is a technicality. You gotta throw. But and like, you know, the media like is barely covering this. So I posted a satire tweet that was like, well, as we all know, American black people are infallible, are morally perfect. And if they ever commit anything wrong, it's due to racism, slavery, and white people's oppression. And I got like 980 likes. Yeah, if racist
that's
tweets
like
always
when
do
I post,
really well.
That's like
in the algorithm.
When I posted the thing about the Jennifer Lawrence cover of Vogue. I've never gotten so much. Like my phone was exploding with how many likes I got for being like, "Wow, it's amazing that you came out as liberal in 2022."
I know,
you're so brave.
Stunning and brave, Jennifer. Stunning and brave. But Amy Sherald's painting.
You know, liberalism has died when she's gone on board.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But Amy Sherald's paintings literally look like CNN's depiction of American black people. That just feels like totally like a lie. Like her painting just looks like a big fucking lie to me. Like it doesn't take much observation to know that there's a lot of issues in urban fucking POC communities. Like this is such a academic sanitization of reality, and I don't mind creating a fantasy so much, but a fantasy is not the same thing as a lie. She's like,
that's also
lying.
Like if that is your fantasy, you need to get some more exciting fantasies, because like
totally.
I mean, and also the thing that drives me crazy about her in particular is that like
because Kerry James Marshall paints black people with the flesh is always, you know, in grayscale.
Yeah.
I just feel like she just stole it from him. And it's like the only other color in the painting is, of course, not coming from the person of color themselves. So I don't know. It just seems really derivative.
And Kerry James is kind of good sometimes. I mean, he has a lot of paintings, but some of them are quite good, I think.
Yeah, they can be pretty spectacular in person. But like when he did it, it was smart. Like it was interesting to paint the flesh in that kind of way, because it was kind of an invention of his, and then she just kind of like piggybacked off of it and made more boring paintings. Yeah. So, yeah.
Sorry to derail the conversation. I'm just catching up on my rage porn.
Rage porn?
Yeah. Mm. A 24-year-old LA woman is recovering from a traumatic brain injury after a homeless man. Yeah. Homeless black man, but you know. What did the mom? This girl's so cute. Her mom says, "I understand this is a very sick person." This guy just stabbed your fucking daughter in the brain. God, liberals are like, they're like gone. If somebody ever stabbed someone I care about in the fucking brain with garden shears, I would be like, this degenerate piece of filth needs to be thrown to the fucking furnace. I don't care about his fucking mental problems. Anyways, Jordan Castile, what a bitch, am I right?
Well, that's one way to put it. I'm sure she's a lovely person. I'm not a mean-hearted person, but
you think? I don't know. She has the glasses. She can't,
but she can't paint. Or she can just paint at like the sort of, it's like the way she paints the figures is very like painting one at a reputable art school in the Midwest or something. Mm. Like it's very like, oh, let's like delineate all the planes of the face and like but then even just like, without sounding super racist, the flesh tones are just rendered with like four different colors, and it's like, okay, you know, every time there's a plane change the color changes, like let's not be so lazy, let's mix in some dark reds and some dark greens that should be in there. So if you're just being like a like, if I was teaching painting one, I would literally be critiquing her on that.
True. Dude, like, but I've seen her get compared to, like, critics Alice. Really fall on their ass to compare her to people. Like, I've seen her, like, I guess the Alice Neal thing kind of makes sense, and I actually think Alice Neal is quite a bit overrated, but not as bad as Castile is.
And well, when you see a really great Alice Neal painting, it is really great. But like,
it has some emotional depth.
Yeah, and there's more than four different flesh colors happening.
Yeah, but I mean, like, she's been compared to, I think Jerry Saltz compared her to fucking like Matisse and Nancy Spiro.
Like, come on. Yeah. Both of those things are ludicrous, but
Nancy Spiro especially. Spiro is like a very specific style.
Yeah, I don't know how you can really compare any. I mean, I'm trying to think of anyone I would even compare to Nancy Spiro. There aren't that many people. But the funny story I wanted to say was that a certain friend of mine who I will not name had just the funniest reaction to when she had the show at the New Museum. And on the top two floors was like the Peter Saul retrospective. And then it was like a floor of Jordan Castile. And my friend was just like, I feel so bad for Jordan. That's just brutal, going from seeing like Peter Saul's like early work and like the Vietnam paintings, like going to seeing like Jordan Castile. It was just like, that did her no favor.
Just something with like technique and humor and style, and then something that's just like so annoying and awful. I mean, I don't know, Jordan Castile is just like, her content drives me nuts too.
I hate like straight up portraiture, so I'm like biased against what she basically does. So I will just say that I pretty much don't like straight up portraiture or figurative painting. That's like even worse is just this sort of like domestic scenes of regular people. Like, I don't care what your race is, I'm just bored. Like, you know, you could paint as beautifully as Vermeer and I'd still be fucking bored, you know?
Yeah.
So because nobody can paint like that anymore. So it's like there's a certain degree to which, like, if you're going to like earnestly be making figurative paintings to a certain degree, it's like there's a certain degree of skill and stuff that has been lost through time. So like you can't really like go back and even like you can't even try to go toe-to-toe with Velasquez. It's just like you just are just fucking nuts if you think you can, you know. So
I think Nguyen is really good at that.
I was actually just about to say that before we got on here, because when I saw the show also, it was something that like I felt like he was doing something really smart, where the sort of like, you know, the demons that would be in a sort of like Sassetta painting or something, they look like creatures that you'd be like battling in Final Fantasy X or something.
Yeah, totally. So
it was like a very weird mix. He's doing a very interesting mix of like high and low that I think is probably so subtle that it goes over a lot of people's heads. Like,
Yeah, I think that's exactly what he's doing.
It looks like 14th century Italian painting meets like video games from the late 90s.
Totally.
In a way that's really smart.
He just had a painting auction for fucking $500,000.
I mean, I'm not surprised. He's good.
Yeah.
I'm not mad at that.
My God, can we talk about one more painter who I absolutely fucking despise?
For the low price of $500,000, you could buy my entire output of work that I've made in my life probably three times over. But go ahead. betting $500,000 on him if you think that's a smart investment.
Do you remember, like, in the early 2010s, or like maybe like early mid to 2010s, they just dropped like 40 black painters into the market all at once, and they all seem to be doing like a similar wobbly goobly, like, representational figurative painting. There was like Shabalala Self. Do you know her?
Yeah, I'm not going to try to pronounce any of their names because I'm pretty sure that would be a hate crime.
Shabalala!
But yeah, I know exactly. I know exactly who. Well, that was I'm gonna also butcher her name, but it was like Evgenia Baras or whatever. Like, I thought that she was black, and then I realized she was like Eastern European.
wait.
Just from the name, I was like,
oh, 15 shit. Orient.
I don't know, but she showed with. I'm drawing a blank because I just had a stroke, but. Yeah, she had the kind of assemblage paintings that would have like ropes and like found objects put in them. The paint would be like really crusty. She's actually quite good, I think. And like a sort of forced best, a sort of weird totemic forced best kind of way. She's quite good.
Yeah, Shabalala is more just like a little, see, the art world sort of will never admit this. But when
it's kind of like, it was kind of like, it was like when, well, there, yeah, there were all these collage based, like Wang Getchi Mutu and stuff. There were
yeah,
a whole,
yeah, Wang Getchi's sort of like the most prestigious of that, at least market wise.
Right.
And Shabalala Self is more just like a young little sex object. Because she's pretty and she's got a big smile. And
I have no idea what she looks like.
I am such an asshole because I actually know her a little bit personally, but I'm just going to paywall this and assume she's never going to hear it.
You know,
yo,
yeah, okay. I don't have anything to say about that work.
What about Jill Moliti?
Weird painter. I don't know if I like Jill Moliti either, but like, I remember seeing that weird show at the Swiss Institute that was just like one giant painting and like chain link fence.
Yeah, I kind of remember that.
It was like a giant storm drain and then like a chain link fence and just like one giant nutty painting of like a woman in a landscape that was just kind of like, I wasn't necessarily on board with it, but I was like very amused with it. I was like, okay, I can. But like, she's also not a particularly like, at least I didn't see her in the recent shows, but she's a very like thin tentative painter. Like she doesn't handle the paint. She doesn't handle paint with a whole lot of confidence.
They almost look like drawings, sort of like weird, uncanny drawings more than they do paintings.
Yeah, like they could be watercolors almost.
For sure. What about that painter, Yana Euler?
God, those paintings are ugly, but like but that's, I mean, that doesn't mean they're bad though. Like,
I actually like her.
I think she's good. No, I think she's good too, but like they're like, they're so aggressively ugly. Also, I mean, I know that you're friends with Matthew Maloof, and some of his paintings can be so aggressively ugly in a way that's
they definitely kind of came up together and get lumped in together a lot. But to me,
I think
like
of
a
them
very
in a
very funny German, like trolley kind of painting.
Yeah, I mean, the Germans are really good at that.
Yeah, very post Kippenberger.
Yeah, they're very good at just doing the most in a way that is simultaneously really smart and completely lobotomized. But which is good, which is like, you know, I'm actually I'm much more on board with that kind of painting than I am on something that would be like earnest. Like, I just don't like because I don't believe that anyone really is earnest. I think that that's where...
Not in today's world.
No, how could you be?
I mean,
a serious... How could you be a serious person and be earnest right now?
Well, like, sort of like the thing that made David Foster Wallace so great and so compelling as an artist was the fact that he felt this real kind of depression and mourning for earnestness, because he's, but at the same time, he's like the most postmodern fiction writer ever. And sort of the conflict between that, between being like responding to the world you're in, which is inevitably going to come out irreverent, contradictory, and like alienated, but like yearning for earnestness. But then like these kind of visual artists who are like, I'm just longing for beauty and intimacy and black.
And, no, don't forget that. Don't forget the. No, let's hate on my people too. Let's hate on the LGBT. Let's hate on the queer people, because I can as a gay white male, I can hate on my community. No, I'm just kidding.
No, yeah. Who's a good example of bad of on? Because like it's weird. Because gay men are. To me, gay men like created Western culture. But at the same time, now it does seem like gay people are sort of like the guinea pigs for psychological operations in a lot of ways. Like gay men have allowed themselves to be totally pushed out of the LGBT movement in favor of like increasingly marginal identities that don't even really exist. And surely there's pushback against this, but
yeah, I was just reading that, like, it was funny because I was just reading that, like, the they got rid of, I actually knew the guy who used to be the head of the sort of gay pride organization or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now it was like all the people that are involved and work with the gay pride organization, the only identity they don't have is a gay man.
Yeah, I remember reading
they had one in like the one who was there was like non-white, like it wasn't like it was like a white man that was like running it, but like now they don't even have a gay man.
That's so nuts. You know what's so really offensive to me,
so it's just LG. I don't think they ever cared about the bisexual, so I'm pretty sure they're not on it. But like, it's just lesbians and trans people now.
Yeah,
and queer people, really, and the non-binary, the two-spirit people. So it's two spirits, lesbians, and two spirits, lesbians.
Were they trying to add asexuals to the list too, which is like really offensive because nobody ever got the ever living shit kicked out of them for being asexual.
No. although the few people that I've met that I actually believe are asexual deal with a certain kind of they deal with an existential terror that's on another level from anyone else. So like they need their own organization, because like to be an asexual person, I think, is like a really difficult and fucked up thing to be.
Yeah, it sounds
almost as bad as being a pedophile, but not quite.
Yeah, not like, I mean, pedophilia is probably the worst, because
yeah,
your desire is criminal and can't ever not be criminal. But I guess not wanting to fuck ever would probably make connecting with other human beings pretty difficult.
It does. It may definitely really makes things difficult. But speaking of earnestness, I suppose I guess in literature people can get away with, well, I don't know. This is a good one, because I'm reading, you'll probably correct my pronunciation, but Otessa Moshva's new Labvona.
Yeah.
And like, somehow I feel like she's like earnest and like deeply ironic at the same, she's very good at doing both somehow.
I agree. Well, she seems to be in that sort of David Foster Wallace vein in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And it's, I guess, in terms of how she's dealing with the content, I think is very, like, visual artists could take a lot of notes from her in terms of, like, how she, I mean, she, you know, the book has everything. It has all the most transgressive, fucked up things that could possibly be in a book. But, like, it's dealt with in a way that's, like, you know, the first half, you're the sort of retarded child. has you know, the father is super abusive, and he keeps telling the child that the reason is his mother died in childbirth or whatever. Yeah, and then like bold. in an offhanded two sentence thing, you find out that his mother was like an underage prisoner that he was like raping, and that's how she got pregnant. but they only just say it in like. They say it in like three sentences as if there's no sort of moral judgment, no sort of like, it's just like, oh, that's how he was conceived. And she tried to abort it and it didn't work. And she ran away to the nunnery. And then that was it. And then it's like never mentioned again.
Yep. I mean, Otessa is remarkable because she doesn't make any statements justifying why she does this kind of work. Critics seem to be aware that it's very provocative, but at the same time have like totally accepted her as an elite fiction writer. I don't know. I really like, I wrote that essay about her because I'm fascinated because she's so clearly the real deal, and there's no one else at her level of the publishing industry coming close to that kind of content. And at the same time, it's like, It's not just like edgelordy shock jock fiction, like there's always it's a not place at for all. That stuff, but it is capital L literature.
I mean, she's writing like a class. It's like a classic novel. I mean, like it's not like it's not even like she's really changing anything with the form of the novel. It's not that kind of novel. I mean. In a certain kind of way, like when I read Samuel Delaney's Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders, like it has a similar kind of like tone, but it's like, of course, that's like gay, interracial, southern, bizarre incest stuff that happens to be quite nice to read.
Oh man, Samuel Delaney is the best.
Yeah, he's the best. He really is.
And also a writer who kind of would make sense as a influence over a lot of artwork. His work is very, very, very aesthetic, very visual. Did you read any of Otessa's older books?
I've only read Year of Rest and Relaxation and this. Yeah. Which of course I identified. That's somebody who worked at a gallery and sort of had a mental breakdown and wished that I could have slept for a year. And I kind of did. I kind of did. So, it was very, I was just like, oh my God, somebody's writing this book. I mean, I didn't inherit a bunch of money and get to live in an Upper East Side apartment, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Her book, Eileen, which is really, really very, you know, because her early books are almost coming from this kind of weird fiction angle. Like, there's this great bookstore in Providence called the Lovecraft Museum. And they sell like weird fiction stuff, horror fiction, like manga, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, you got all your usual customers there. You got your Lovecrafts, your Ligottis. But I was there browsing and they had both of her. They had McGlue and Eileen, her two first books. So she's really kind of accepted even outside the high literature spheres. Like she's getting recognition amongst the weirdo types. And her book,
She doesn't write in a way that's difficult to understand. She writes in like a very, you know, everything is very succinct. There's not a lot of bullshit, difficult kind of sentence structure or anything. Like it's very, everything's very matter of fact.
Yeah. Yeah. Very declarative, very nice writing style. And apparently Eileen is being, she's already had a bunch of movie adaptation like offers, like Yorgos Lanthimos was supposed to do Year of Rest and Relaxation. I think
I know, that I was project so excited about shelved. That.
But
oh, that sucks.
I think it's shelved for the moment. But she is doing an adaptation of Eileen. She adapted her own script with her own book with her husband. And it's going to be directed by William Oldroyd, who has only done one film so far called Lady Macbeth, which was excellent. It has nothing to do with the Lady Macbeth. It's more like spiritually influenced by Lady Macbeth as an idea. And it's like right. this girl who's married to this brute landowner and in like Victorian England, and she starts fucking her like little hot looking, sort of compellingly ugly Irish slave boy. and then starts like flaunting it in front of all the servants, and then just becomes increasingly more evil. It's very Otessa Mosvig, the whole thing.
It so I'm sounds
very curious to see how that goes.
It sounds like a winner to me.
Yeah, yeah, me too, me too. What about movies? Have you seen any recently you liked?
In the last few years, I have sort of given up on movies, which I know there's a lot of really good ones. Mm. I just, every time I'm watching a movie, I just feel like I want to be painting, so I never finish anything because I just go back to the studio and end up painting. That's unless it's really stupid. Unless it's like really stupid. Like, I've just watched trash, but, or porn. I watch a lot of porn, but, I watched the worst thing ever, though.
What was that?
Recently, just because I got sucked into it. Was that new TV show, The Watcher.
The Watcher? What's that?
It has Jennifer Coolidge, Naomi Watts. It has a crazy cast. And it's basically just like, I mean, the plot is so unbelievably ridiculous and stupid that you can't believe it at all. Like, Naomi Watts plays like she's like a ceramicist who's like married to some finance dude and has like two kids. And they're basically buying like this big old mansion in New Jersey or whatever. They're leaving the city because they're worried about the city being too dangerous.
Mm.
And like Jennifer Coolidge plays the real estate broker that sells them the house. But she was a painting major at RISD. So I got sucked into it just because I was just like, wait, what? Like, Jennifer Coolidge was a painting major at RISD who's now a real estate broker in a really fancy neighborhood in New Jersey. Like, I was like, the show is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. So then, oh yeah, and then Mia Farrow plays the crazy neighbor. So it's...
Well, that's believable.
Yeah, that's believable. So I just got sucked into watching it, but it is the absolute worst piece of trash I've ever seen. But... Yeah.
You got to watch Blonde, though.
No, I really want to see it, especially after what, especially after the New York Times trashed it and you gave it a glowing review. I was like, well, that sounds like something I should see.
It's a 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
Like, hard 10 out of 10. Best thing I've seen in years.
Is it based on the Joyce Carol Oates?
Yeah.
Blonde? Yeah.
Yeah, it's an adaptation of it.
Okay.
And that book is also fucking great.
Yeah,
I've Joyce never Carol, read it. She's one of my favorite shit posters, Joyce Carol Oates.
Oh, is she a good shit poster?
She really is, because she's like one of these like libtards who will like sort of half-assedly criticize libtardism, but she has so many followers that even like the most mild criticisms of it just earn her like the craziest hatred and scorn. I really love watching that shit.
Yeah.
Fuck, what was I gonna say? I don't know. There's been a lot of video games recently that have come out. There's a lot of media that comes out More than ever, probably. I just feel like everything is like too fractured for anybody to really like. It's interesting. Like, there's no sort of discourse being produced. It's going to be very interesting history to look back on because everything's going to seem like, did anything even happen?
Yeah.
You know, I really feel like that's what's going to happen. 20 years, we're going to be like, did we actually, do we exist?
Well, everything is so trend. Everything is so trend driven and it moves so fast that it's basically just like, everything is just like, now everyone bleaching their eyebrows blonde. that whole thing that has just gotten so ridiculous, but it's just like, pretty much like every single movement in art right now is basically like bleaching your eyebrows blonde. Like that's like the extent of the depth of it. So like in a few years, everyone's going to be like, I don't know. I mean, when there were all those straight white dudes making, you know, the zombie formula, everyone was making paintings that looked like Christopher Wool for like 4 years.
Yeah, I remember.
And
fucking Walter Robinson.
I'm kind of amazed that I'm surprised the current moment of figurative painting has lasted as long as it has, but I think that maybe the only reason why it's lasted that long is because it's so embedded in liberal politics. I think that's the only reason why it's lasted as long as it has, because like all the artists are tired of it. I mean, I don't know a single artist that's like excited about it.
Yeah.
At all. Like, yeah. I've never met anybody. I've literally never met a single artist who's just like, Jordan Castile really does it for me. I don't think that anyone is very excited about this kind of work. So like, I guess the only reason why it's hanging on is because of probably, you know, Trump, unfortunately. I think as long as people are psychotically afraid of Trump coming back in power, there's going to be this kind of WPA thing happening. And then, you know.
And he's coming back, so I guess we're stuck with this.
Yeah,
I mean, the Trump, and I guess the thing with conceptual art now, I mean, there's not even much great installation work or video work being done.
No.
Like definitely, you don't see a lot of those shows anymore. And to the extent that they are, they're always these like skull numbing, like social practice. Like, you know, there's no. I mean, you social have like the old. You the, have like the old
social practice is the gayest fucking thing that's ever happened. Like it, yeah, it is.
That's
it
how
is
you really, win a Turner Prize now.
It's really like. I mean, when I studied in Detroit, it was very much like, I mean, it was crazy to me to think that like, so my school, they gave up, they had these amazing senior studios. And that was like one of the reasons why people even went there was so that you would get this amazing studio at the end to kind of just go nuts in.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave it up my senior year because they had this social practice nincompoop who was like running the program at that point, who ended up getting fired for some very salacious reasons or whatever. But like the
I just literally blew up the fucking stove.
So like it was just crazy because it was after the financial crisis. It was when you could literally buy a house for $500 or less. And and it was like, this was the time when they decided it would be a good idea to give up real estate and talk about being a post-studio artist. And I was like, are you fucking nuts? Like, this is like the one place where you can actually get real estate in the United States that's cheap enough that like artists can. I was like, why is there no good painting and sculpture in Detroit? Because literally all they have is space. And all the artists are like, I'm going to make sleeping bags for homeless people and read Derrida. It's like, okay, great, like whatever.
Oh god, I would assassinate someone for doing that.
Yeah, I was like, your head is so far up your ass
I mean, it's like they were all part of that like Mildred Lane cult, that like Recrit, Tyrvanese, whatever the fuck, or
yeah,
Mark Dion and all those people. They were very just like Allison Knowles, Fluxus. Yeah.
Right.
Did you
buy property?
I'm a painter. What? Did I buy a house?
In Detroit.
I wish.
Totally. You'd be selling that shit for $400,000 by now.
Yeah. No, it's because it's really expensive now. I mean, it's like Detroit is as expensive as Chicago and LA, basically, at this point. It's like,
whoa.
It's like the because my parents actually like tried to bribe me with real estate. They were like, you can stay in Detroit and we'll help you get. It was basically like the equivalent of, they have this super famous apartment building. It's called the Park Shelton. It's right next to the DIA. It's like where Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo lived, you know, while he was doing the mural. And she did the famous painting of the woman jumping out of the window. So it's like a very historic, and they're like beautiful old apartments. And at the time you could buy one for like $20,000. And I was like, no, I'll move to New York and spend $20,000 a year on rent.
right.
But yeah, like now those things I think are like over $500,000 for sure.
Damn. Yeah, I don't know much about Detroit's art world. I know a few
artists
come from there.
I mean, if you're a gay person, you just literally have to drive 15 miles to get dick. And like with the price of gas right now, I don't know. I'm not into that.
Totally. Yeah, I know Olivia Zivich's gallery because she's married to Nate Young from Wolf Eyes. But I don't know. I've never been to Detroit. Maybe I should visit there at some point, but maybe not. I don't
You'd
know.
Probably. It's really good for straight dudes, I think. Mm. Yeah.
My friend Zach used to work at a record store there that dealt mainly in like funk and soul and jazz LPs. And this was like,
That's the best thing about Detroit is the music, for sure.
Oh, of course. It's super rich in pop music history.
But yeah. It's like the only reason, it's like the reason to be there.
Yeah. All right. You know what? I think we now have like 2.5 hours of audio. I think we're probably good.
Yeah, we're probably good. Should I maybe, if we are going to do an outro from my musical situation, should I just
send me the one you want to use?
Okay, great. I will.
All right. I'll talk to you soon, Kev.
Bye.
Later.
Old Chelsea Queen, I see your Lauderdale tan and your Juvederm Kintsugi. Lipodystrophy is a bitch, and yet you are still here. With obligatory cock rings stretching the inseam, a peacock in broad daylight, your xenomorph offering delights me. Subtlety is overrated. A person of color walks by, pushing a matte gray Swiss baby stroller with commensurate gurgling white maggots. A thin white woman with tiny dog evades us the way incompatible magnets repel. It's too expensive to rent. Why bother to fill these empty stores when one has an excellent for Matthias Waldbach and site-specific piece accumulating on vacant real estate like moss on a rock? You aren't going to find any hot ass on 8th Avenue anymore. I may be a 90-pound blonde affluent East Coast girl. I do not, however, have a tiny fucking dog. Your side eye even meets my smoky eye. Lingering on your unattributed, never Gaston Lachaise. smile, I smile. Is widow porn really anything? One should clutch pearls over. Oh, Chelsea Queen, I salute you. I will blow clouds on Hunter Biden's cock to Frankie Knuckles in your honor.